Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my. The former CIA interrogator, John Kiraku, if I'm pronouncing that right, was on ABC News last night, CIA official, head of the team who was involved in apparently torturing people, and was asked, you know, did you guys just do this on your own, or did this come down from the White House, or what? He says, this isn't something done willy-nilly. It's not something an agency officer just wakes up in the morning and decides he's going to do. This was policy made at the White House. Yeah. So, fanaticism in the modern world, whether it's fanaticism coming out of the White House, fanaticism coming out of, well, you know, science, coming out of religion, we're seeing, arguably, this is the... The way of, I mean, this is the White House idea of how to deal with fanaticism coming out of the fanatical Muslim sects. How do we deal with fanatical Christian sects? How do we deal with fanatical secularism? John G. West on the line with us. He's a senior fellow at the Seattle-based Discovery Institute, the organization that is one of the primary promoters of creationism in the United States. Discovery.org, their website. He's the author of a new book, Darwin Day in America, How Our Politics and Cultures Have Been Dehumanized in the Name of Science. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. But I have to say that we don't promote creationism. We promote intelligent design, which I know some people think is creationism, but we disagree. So.
Okay. Well, you know, point made. Here's a question that I've always wanted to ask, and this isn't in the context of a debate. I don't have some snappy comeback regardless of your answer. I just genuinely am curious what your response to this answer is.
Mm-hmm.
If you believe that everything that we see around us is the consequence of an intelligent designer as opposed to an evolutionary process, and having spent some time with your book, I get it that that's the basis of the book, and certainly that's the basis of the foundation that sponsored you in this book and the work that you're doing. Who designed the designer?
Well, that's a great question. I don't think from science you actually can know, identify who the designer is. And I think, but the way you phrase it, I would.
But from religion, I mean, you're coming in at it from a religious point of view. You're assuming that there is, you know, an intelligent designer of all these things. Where did that intelligence designer come from?
I mean, I don't think that comes from a religious point of view. Even the co-creator of the theory of evolution by natural selection, Alfred Wallace, disagreed with Charles Darwin on the point of whether nature pointed toward an intelligent design. This is a debate we've been having since the ancient Greeks. Part of my whole book is to place this in a broader intellectual context. This has been going on for, you know, 2 millennia or more. It's not just about Darwin, but on, you know, the issue of you know, who the designer is or who created the designer, I don't think that's a scientific question. I don't think that it's a choice between evolutionary biology or intelligent design. I think that evolution can explain many things. I don't think it can explain everything. I don't think it explains some of the things Darwin thought it explains, particularly an unguided process of selection and random variations. But I don't. Intelligent design, strictly speaking, as I point out in my book, does not oppose evolution with a small e.
Yeah, so,
but my book,
so
is more generally less. You know, I have a couple chapters on that. But I was really intrigued how you began the segment, which is, I think, the underlying theme of my book. You know, Darwin is part of it, but is this effort to help acquaint people that just like there can be fanatical religious people that we ought to be concerned about, and just like the history, not just of Islam, but also of Christianity, you can find fanatics who have done things that we should be skeptical of. There also is scientists. Leading scientists can also be just as fanatical as any religious fundamentalist.
Oh, Francis Galton, Sir Francis Galton, the half cousin of Charles Darwin, the economist who used Darwin's theories, and some say influenced Darwin's theories, used it to justify Victorian-era economics, used it to justify trickle-down economics. I mean, Galton's work was cited by the Reagan guys. You know, it's been cited by conservatives forever. He invented the word eugenics.
And actually, part of my book tells about the misuse of this both by conservatives and liberals. In fact, one of the heroes of my story in the era of criminal justice, which applied this approach...
William Jennings Bryan.
I talk about him, but it was Thurgood Marshall. Because in the 60s, there was an effort to basically make all crime a disease. Now, the liberals initially thought that was great because then you could let people off easier and not imprison them. But then the conservatives came back and said, well, if it's really a disease, then that means that we can lock them up until they're cured. And if they're never cured, they never get out. And we can do things like lobotomize them and do treatments that would never be allowed as punishment because they'd be cruel and unusual. But if they're for their good, then we could use them as treatments. And,
and don't you think,
Marshall
though,
was one of the people who helped put a stop to that.
Yeah, and good on him for doing it. Don't you think, though, that there is some sort of a rational middle ground that we can be informed that genetics do predispose people to certain behaviors and environment influences people towards certain behaviors, and on top of all of that, there is at some level free choice?
Yes, and I agree with that. And I think that's a common sense view. The problem is you have leading scientists who think that that's compromising good science. And in, say, the eugenics movement, for four decades, you had leaders of the National Academy of Sciences, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, who were basically saying, you know, it's all heredity, and that's why we shouldn't bother about things like social programs, because forget about giving people a hand up, because they're genetically, by their inheritance, that's where they're going to be. So all we can do to get rid of them is to sterilize them to get rid of them. Because
this was the eugenics movement in the United States in the 1920s and 30s, but it's largely discredited now. I mean, you know, Hitler did a very good job of discrediting the American eugenics movement by trumpeting it.
But I think the sort of blind fanaticism in the name of science even exists today. I mean, right now you have a evolutionary biologist at University of Texas who's so concerned about overpopulation. His name is Eric Pianca. He thinks that we should reduce the population by up to 90%, and he advocates sterilizing everyone in the United States.
And this is what I find throughout your book, though, is that you find these extremists and you hold them up, and I would suggest that most of them are straw men. I think that, you know, most Americans are occupying some sort of a middle ground where they're acknowledging, first of all, Darwin, you know, very few scientists would say that Darwin's concept of slow gradual evolution is even, you know, the accepted theory nowadays. It's more punctuated evolution, you know, that you have bottlenecks, and what comes out of the bottlenecks is, you know, Stephen Jay Gould's theory from Harvard back in the 1980s.
Unfortunately, poor Stephen Jay Gould was berated by his fellow Darwinists for just saying that.
At the time, but now he's acknowledged as probably being right. But nonetheless, it's in your book you talk about the more scientists investigated the foundations of life, the more they were confronted with the disconcertingly looked like evidence of mind. I mean, your book is an eloquent defense of you said it's not creationism, it's intelligent design. Darwin Day in America, how our politics and culture have been dehumanized in the name of science. We're talking with John West. What if the mind that you are asserting that scientists are seeing, what if that is evidence of the material world rather than the other way around?
Well, if you have a broad enough view of the material world that it includes mind as an irreducible property, just like matter and energy, then it certainly could be a part of the natural world.
Well, you assert that humans are uniquely different from all other nature, all the rest of nature. Am I correct in quoting you on that?
I think there is a uniqueness there, but I actually would agree with Darwin that you find a lot of things, evidence of mind in the rest of nature. But what I don't think is, and I don't think Darwin explained
it. But you say, I mean, right in the dust jacket of your book, when scientists and politicians deny the essential difference between human beings and the rest of nature, what is, you know, how are we different from the rest of nature? Are we not animals?
But I would say that we're more than animals. It depends how you describe animals. I think that in the capacity for rational choice and reason deliberation, the difference is so vast.
Do you think nothing else in nature has a spirit or a soul or whatever that animating thing is that you're accrediting to humans?
That's an interesting question. I think in the area of human culture, you could just see, regardless of any religious presuppositions, you can see that in the effects of human culture, actually someone like G.K. Chesterton pointed this out in the early 20th century, you can find bird nests, in, you know, birds creating these small nests. You don't find them creating palaces. I mean, or the vast difference in how human beings handle and create technology and art and use sort of, you know, rational deliberation, I think, is a gulf between us and the rest of nature.
Okay. John West, you know, I would assert that it's just part of a spectrum, but, you know, it's I guess that's where we'll part company. Darwin Day in America, How Our Politics and Culture Have Been Dehumanized in the Name of Science. John G. West, the book, the author. John, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199 fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Let's join the rest of the world, eh? Or at least the rest of the industrialized, intelligent, together world. The Family Research Council... I'm sorry. The nutcases are coming out of the woodwork. You got Bill O'Reilly out there pursuing his war on Hanukkah, claiming in reverse that it's actually a war on Christmas on the part of the press. It's actually on the part of Bill O'Reilly and Fox News, a war on every other religion other than Christianity. I mean, that's the bottom line.
So. All those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
And then he wants to throw us in jail. Oh, well, in any case, it's so. And the Family Research Council comes out, and here we had this. There have been a number of tragic shootings recently, the most recent in a mega church in Colorado. Tony Perkins says, "It's hard not to draw a line between the hostility that is being fomented in our culture from some of the secular media toward Christians." Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. I haven't seen any hostility toward Christians in the media. And by secular media, I'm assuming he's talking about corporate-owned media as opposed to radio and television stations that sell time to folks like Tony Perkins and televangelists who then, you know, go on and ask for money. And if they make more money than the time costs them, then they keep buying that time and they can ultimately become very profitable. Pat Robertson is purported to be worth $1 billion. I mean, he's made $1 million 1,000 times. Not too shabby, particularly when you do it without having to pay taxes on it. You know, it's a tax-free corporations and things. But, you know, here these guys are out here claiming that there's a war on Christmas, there's a war on Christianity. It seems to me like that's the antithesis of the things that Christ taught, if nothing else, the antithesis of the core of most religions. You know, I feel like Rodney King sometimes. Can't we all just get along? But, I mean, it's... This whole thing of we've got to teach intelligent design in our schools, but we can't explain to you who designed the designer, but we know that there's a design. You know, come on, science has rationally described most of these things. That doesn't mean that religion can't be there for people. It doesn't mean that spirituality isn't real. It doesn't mean that there aren't mysteries. It just means that the mystery of how life came about has been, by and large, in the opinion of most scientists, solved. And we're seeing life not just on Earth, but you know, in microbes that come from outer space. There's some very, very solid evidence that meteorites that have struck the Earth are carrying life forms. And in fact, that perhaps Earth was seeded in its very early days, although DNA seems to arise ultimately and eventually out of various life forms, that probably actually on this planet started not on the surface, and not photosynthetically, but probably started in deep ocean vents around, you know, that were sulfur-based life forms, and used the heat of the ocean as their primary source of life. I mean, you go back, the science is becoming increasingly clear and frankly fascinating that there was a time when this planet's atmosphere was toxic to everything that we call life right now. And, you know, that there was very little oxygen in the atmosphere. And that one particular type of bacteria that was living off the heat of the ocean vents and the sulfur coming out of the volcanic activity under the sea, that one of these types of bacteria mutated and eventually became essentially a, you know, the early plant, an early single-celled plant species that used sunlight, that used photosynthesis to take carbon dioxide and perhaps sulfur out of the atmosphere and out of the seawater and released oxygen. And in the process of releasing oxygen, the oxygen level of our atmosphere started increasing dramatically over hundreds of millions of years until it reached the point where there was a huge die-off. And the oxygen was so toxic that it killed like 80, 90, maybe more percent of all life on Earth. And we're talking, you know, a billion years ago, more or less, as I recall. And that led to a whole brand new form of life on Earth, an oxygen-based form of life on Earth. And we're part of that. We're the ultimate, you know, we're the peak of that. But that doesn't mean that you can't, you know, look out at the stars at night and experience the mystery, experience, as Ben Franklin called it. In fact, he wrote a book, The Mystery. You can't experience awe, that there isn't something that is ultimately intelligent, but perhaps it interpenetrates everything. Perhaps it is everything. Perhaps it's greater than anything we can imagine. Perhaps by trying to anthropomorphize all of this and say, oh, it's an old guy with a beard, maybe we're making it much smaller than it really is. I don't claim to have the answers. I just am very concerned about people who do claim to have all the answers, saying that they want to rewrite our textbooks in our schools for our kids. Concerns me greatly. 27 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270. Your thoughts coming up next.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. Oh.
Four minutes past the hour. Just a quick reminder, this Friday, December 14th, 7 p.m., I'll be at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at Kauffman Memorial Union, giving about an hour speech or riff or rant or whatever you want to call it on Cracking the Code, the Art and Science of Political Persuasion, and signing books as well. So if you want to pick one up, hopefully they'll have more than just Cracking the Code there. I've got 7 books on politics out of the 20 books I have in print right now. So if y'all are listening there at Kauffman Memorial Union, pick up some books. Get ready. Here we come. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Chris in Michigan. Hey, Chris, thanks for calling. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to, your guest mentioned that he's for intelligent design, not creationism. Well, in my opinion, that sounds exactly what you're talking about in Cracking the Code. Anybody who tries to say that intelligent design is separate from creationism, in my opinion, is a liar.
I get it. They've reinvented it, and it's essentially the same thing. No, I don't disagree. I just, at a certain point, it's not worth beating somebody over the head and shoulders because they've decided to change the language of what they're doing. The good news is that Americans are figuring out that intelligent design and creationism are essentially the same, or at least have the same basis.
Well, I find the real danger there is because if intelligent design does get taught in schools, which a lot of individual counties and school districts aren't successfully getting lobbied that way from the religious right, that's a big danger on us as a society, because if a student learns about intelligent design, their next question obviously is going to be, well, who is the designer? And to my opinion, that's a perfect end for the religious right to say, well, it's God. And lucky for you, we have the Bible. In my opinion, the short-sightedness of people who believe in intelligent design and creationism is they look at the world as it is now, and believe that's the way it always has been, and that's the way it always will be. Just because birds are building nests and not palaces now doesn't mean that in a million years they won't be building palaces. They just look at the world now and say, well, that's the way it must have always been and always will be.
Yeah, well, and many of them think the world is only 6,000 years old on top of that, which makes it even more confusing. But,
yeah, but if you ignore that scientific evidence, that's real easy to believe.
Yeah, good point, Chris. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Julius in Detroit. Hey, listening on WDTW. Hey, Julius.
Hi, how are you?
Just great.
Yeah, and you're going to get better.
You betcha.
I listen all the time, I want to try to be both lighthearted and serious on the topic of intelligent design.
Mm-hmm.
The same question that you posed to your guest,
mm-hmm.
I posed to myself some 30 years ago.
Right.
And the
you
answer
mean, you
that
mean
I
if,
got,
if the universe was created by an intelligence or an intelligent being, then who created that intelligent being? Is that the question you're talking about?
Right. Well, of course, you know, since I had been brought up in a religious background, the question that I posed in my own head was, who made God? You know, that was the question. But it's basically the same as the question that you asked your guest.
Right.
Just different words. But some years later, the answer for me I found in the Egyptian Book of the Dead.
Oh, that's interesting. I have read the Egyptian Book of the Dead.
The answer that I saw there was, I made myself, which is, you know, so like I said, I was being both lighthearted and very, very serious about the things that you propose as a Christian.
Yeah, interesting.
I don't disagree with them at all.
Yeah, I just honestly don't know the answer, Julius, and I think that it's just something that's so much larger. I mean, at a certain level, it's like asking an ant if they can do calculus. You know, it's just beyond their ability. It's beyond their comprehension, and there are some things that are frankly beyond my comprehension. But I think your point is an interesting one. And there was a fascinating article, and I'm trying to remember where I read it. It's just in the last couple of weeks. It might have been the New York Times magazine, or it might have been Discover magazine. Or it might have just been something online. I read a lot. And it pointed out that the science of artificial intelligence has reached, no, it wasn't artificial intelligence, it's the science of the ability to create virtual reality, VR, virtual reality, has reached the point where it is now possible to drive inputs directly into the nervous system. So you can create what seems to be real sound, what seems to be real vision, what seems to be real tactile senses, real taste, real smells. You can create all that externally. And you know, it's still a fairly primitive science, but it's there. And so the question is, in a universe full of infinite possibilities, if one of the possibilities is that what we are experiencing right is that it is possible to create a virtual reality so real that a person would experience it and think that it's reality when in fact they are unconscious. They're like floating in a tank or something. If that's possible, then what if that's the reality for all of us? What if we're all experiencing a virtual reality? How do we know that reality is reality? It gets weirder and weirder, doesn't it? Todd in Santa Barbara, California. Hey, Todd.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just great. What's up?
Well, I've noticed that there's kind of two people out there, and we all have a relationship with science. And on one side, the relationship is kind of a fair-weather friend situation where science is only convenient if it's keeping your airplane in the air or finding pockets of oil under the ocean. But when it comes to something inconvenient like global warming, pardon my little pun there,
mm-hmm.
it starts to become something that only the evil Christmas-hating liberals are kind of putting up there to...
Yeah, or the origin of species, yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting how that works and how evolution suddenly starts having the word theory of put in front of it.
Interesting point, Todd. Thank you very much for making it. Josh in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Josh.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Just great. What's up?
Hey, I was calling to say that that science, by definition, is a study of the natural world. And intelligent design and creation is a study of the supernatural world. So by definition, not by choice, science cannot include intelligent design, and it should not be taught in the classroom because there's nothing that could degrade science more than throwing out evidence and logic and reason and theory in place for supernatural solutions.
I agree, absolutely. And just like I think it's such a tragedy. I'm so saddened that we no longer teach civics and, the history of race, the history of labor, the history of the United States. We no longer teach civics in our classrooms. We also don't teach, and frankly, I'm not sure that we ever really did do a good job of teaching, although certainly the founders were quite familiar with it, but we don't teach comparative religion. And intelligent design and creationism and all that stuff should be dropped into comparative religion. There are several different religions that have... Well, every religion has a theory about how the world began. I mean, you know what? In Hinduism, the universe grew out of Vishnu's navel, as I recall. There's some Buddhist sects who have the great turtle theory. Some Native American communities do. I mean, there's all these different creation stories, and most creation stories are actually not stories of the creation. They're stories of the creation of our tribe. I mean, you go back and read Genesis, and Adam and Eve, you know, the first man and woman, right? They had two sons, Cain and Abel. Cain kills Abel, and then Cain leaves, right? He gets banished, and what does he do? He goes to the next town over, and he marries somebody. But where'd she come from? Adam and Eve is not the story of the beginning of the human race. It's the story of one tribe's beginning. Every tribe has a story about how that tribe was the one created by the creator, or the best creator, or the best God. And ultimately, they're the best tribe. And I mean, this is anthropology 101. Why aren't we teaching this in our schools? I don't get it. Don in Sonoma County, California. Hey, Don.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I love your program.
Thank you.
I just finished a book by Graham Hancock called Supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
It's his newest book, Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind.
Isn't Graham Hancock the guy who wrote the book on the Sphinx and the Pyramids?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a brilliant book.
Fingerprints of the Gods.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, this one's the best ever. And the one chapter discusses the guy that discovered DNA.
Right. Are you talking about Watson or Crick? Because there were two of them.
I'm not exactly sure. I was trying to find it here really.
Yeah,
quick.
Watson is the guy who recently discredited himself so badly and got fired by making racist statements and basing them in genetics.
Well, no, this guy made the outrageous statement that he discovered DNA while he was tripping on acid, for one thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that was Watson, too. Yeah.
Okay. And his bottom line was, once he had figured out what DNA was doing or tried to, was that there was no place else it could have come from but outer space, and he felt it was an alien intelligence.
Yeah, well, then, you know, which then raises the question, okay, it came from outer space. Where?
Yeah.
It came from the planet Xenu. How did it get there?
No.
Right, right. It's a recursive thing that just absolutely never ends. Don, thanks for pointing it out. It's a fascinating one. Polly in Portland. Hey, Polly, we've got just a little less than a minute here before we've got to take a break. You're on the air, Polly.
Oh, great. Oh, hi. I'm a college biology teacher, and I actually use John West's website, www.darwindayinamerica.com, the trailer, in my class, because if you would look at the trailer, it's very dark. It starts with a human with an ape's head, and it goes on to attack scientists, saying things like 86% of scientists don't believe in an afterlife, 94% of them think that evolution has no purpose. It doesn't. That's part of evolution. And it's a direct attack.
Interesting. His book is certainly, it's a very gentle, I mean, you know, it's the velvet glove over the iron fist of the attack on science.
The trailer is very dark, very disturbing. I know Jim Watson.
Yeah.
And Jim Watson, what the other fellow said is not true about Watson.
Okay, great. Thanks, Polly, for setting the record straight.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Coming up in our second hour, Terrence Jeffrey's going to be with us with CNS News. Should we punish parents with more than two children because they're contributing to global warming? And in our third hour, Anthony Romero is here. He's the executive director of the ACLU, talking about what's going on with the telco bill, this this bill to grant immunity to the telecom companies that have collaborated with the Bush administration in their criminal wiretapping of you and me. So we'll see where that goes. Simon in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Simon, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I just have a theory that, their whole theory of intelligent design is flawed because if the law of nature states that energy cannot be created nor destroyed, how can there really be a beginning? Because my theory is that we always existed in one state or another, and that if you really believe, like in the theory of a multi-universe, that we're constantly changing. There's no real beginning or end.
Yeah. You know, increasingly scientists are agreeing with you, although the nature of the multiverse or the nature of the continuous, you know, from the Big Bang theory where, you know, it collapses and explodes every 15 to 30 billion years to multiverse, to bubbles, to multiple dimensions. I mean, all of that stuff is being debated, but increasingly... It's like asking an ant to do calculus or asking a cat to do calculus. It's frankly something that I just don't think that we're capable of getting our minds around, at least the way that our minds are right now. And you know, my own personal theology is that at some point, probably at the moment that I die, I will be connected to an intelligence that does understand that. But that's just, you know, my hope and belief. I don't know. Maybe not. Mike in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Tom. I'm a big fan of your show.
Thank you.
Every day. But I did want to take you to task, or as long as you're speaking about religion obliquely, for something that you said about atheism on a previous show a week or so ago. You had characterized atheism as a form of religion, and I just wanted to point out that if atheism is a religion, then by that same logic, not collecting stamps qualifies as a hobby.
Well, if what you did was you walked around all day long and everybody you went up to, you said, I don't collect stamps. And if you had empty stamp albums and you showed them to people and you said, see, there's no stamps in my album, then I would say that that is a hobby and it would be anti-stamp collecting as a hobby.
Anti-philatelist.
That's right. If you were an evangelical anti-philatelist, then I would say that you have a hobby, and it's the anti-philatelism hobby. My take on it, and maybe this is a semantic argument, but my take on it is that agnostics are the honest ones, people who say, I don't have a clue. I don't have any idea. I don't know if there is or there isn't a God. I don't know if it's real or not. That's not a religion. That's genuine skepticism. But when somebody goes out on an essentially evangelical basis and tries to convince people that there isn't a creator or a god or multiple gods, or that all life isn't infused with intelligence or you know, the fire of energy, or you know, from the spectrum of monotheism to pantheism, they're opposed to the whole thing, and they ascribe to a philosophy that has ism at the end of it. I would submit to you that that is a religion.
Well, I would counter that by saying that most there is probably a great silent majority among atheists that are content to simply not believe in a supreme being and leave it at that.
Then I would say they're not atheists. I'd say they're agnostics.
Well, no, an agnostic claims not to know. I claim not to believe. That's an atheist.
Okay, well, if you're claiming not to believe, that's a belief. Because you're making a claim. You're making a claim that you can't back up. It's something that you believe. It's not something you can prove.
It's an absence of belief. That's like saying cold is a...
No, that's agnostic. Agnostic is the absence of belief. You have a positive belief about there not being something.
Well, literally,
just like I have a positive belief about there not being intelligent design.
But the literal meaning of the word agnostic is
one who doubts.
One who doesn't know.
Right, exactly.
But that isn't the same as saying I don't believe.
Yeah, but see, when you put ism at the end of something, I mean, it's Mormonism, Christianism, Islamism. When you put ism at the end of something, you are defining it essentially as a belief structure. And when the belief structure becomes evangelical, when people spend a large chunk of their life running around telling people how they should believe, even though it's a negative belief, that's a religion.
Well, that's probably where we differ on that. I see no need to change everyone's minds.
Yeah. Okay.
And probably
well, that, see, but see, again, in Christianity, for example, just to use one example, I mean, Judaism actually is probably a better example because Judaism is not evangelical, and yet it is religious. Most of Judaism, you could argue that the Lubavitcher Hasidim are evangelical. But, you know, most of Christianity is evangelical, although there are parts of Christianity that are not evangelical. And I'm not sure where I fall in that category. I think I'm probably not particularly evangelical. I have, you know, however somebody wants to believe, that's fine with me. But nonetheless, if you can have a religion without it being evangelical, there's no shortage of them.
Certainly. And probably the crux of the problem is the fact that a term like atheism is it defines a negative term. I am not a thing, as opposed to saying I am a Christian, which says I am this thing.
Right, but defining a negative is defining something as well.
Right, right.
So I think you're making my point. Okay, Mike.
Well, there you go.
Decent people can disagree. Kurt in Salem. Kurt, we just have a few seconds before we've got to wrap up this hour. Quick comment.
Okay, yes. I've been a pastor for some 30 years, and I can't believe we're still debating this topic. You know, God did it. What difference does it make how?
Okay.
How he did it. You know, it just...
Yeah,
it,
if he did it by virtue of evolution, in other words, that's fine with you.
Sorry?
If God did it, or a creator did it, or intelligence did it by virtue of evolution, that's fine with you as a pastor.
Yeah,
me too.
6 billion years. Don't make no sense.
There you go. Whether it's you know, a single god or multiple gods or whatever, you know, however it happens, who knows? But here we are. Here we are, 57 minutes past the hour. How are we going to best deal with global warming coming up next? Stick around. What's the best way to deal with population? Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative con. This is the Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Where smart people get their news.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Back in 2004, conservative John Howard, the Prime Minister of Australia, suggested that the country should pay people to have babies because of a declining birth rate. He wanted to pass out $3,670 per family. But as Patrick Goodenough writes over at the conservative Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com website, but to Barry Walters, a clinical associate professor of obstetric medicine at the University of Western Australia, that undermines the campaign to fight global warming. He points out that in an average 80-year lifetime, you're not just breathing, but you're using resources. This is in the Medical Journal of Australia this Monday. And he says that instead, when somebody has a baby, they should pay $4,380 U.S., that's 5,000 Australian dollars, to buy land and plant trees to offset a lifetime's worth of carbon dioxide. He also says that there should be tax breaks for people who have... who are sterilized, who use diaphragms, condoms, IUDs, contraceptives, things like this to reduce this the size of their families. Another colleague of his writing in the Medical Journal of Australia says, one must wonder why population control, this is Gary Egger, director of the Center for Health Promotion and Research in Sydney, one must wonder why population control, which was such a popular topic during the 70s, is spoken today only in whispers. The debate needs to be reopened as part of the second ecological revolution. Terrence Jeffrey is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of CNS News, where these articles appear at cnsnews.com. Terrence, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
We reached 1 billion people, all of human history, whether it's 6,000 years or whether it's 160,000 years, depending on your point of view, all of human history reached 1 billion people in 1800. Our second billion only took 130 years, 1930. Our third billion only took 30 years, 1960. Our fourth billion only took 14 years, 1974. Our fifth billion only took 13 years, 1987. And our sixth billion only took 11 years, 1999. We are multiplying like rabbits on this planet. Why would you be writing or publishing articles attacking this guy for suggesting that reducing population might be part of the solution to global warming?
Well, first of all, Patrick Goodenough's report doesn't attack anybody. It simply reports what this guy said and puts it out there on the public record. But, I profoundly disagree with this Professor Walters. I think he makes two fundamental mistakes. One is really a theological mistake, and the other mistake is an economic mistake. I think the theological mistake is that he thinks that man is a blight on the planet and that the planet itself is the highest good in creation. I would argue that things on this earth exist for man to use to his benefit and to use in an ordinate way. That's the theological error.
I would submit to you, respectfully, Terrence, that that kind of thinking is what is destroying not just the planet but us as well, and that the thinking behind this was not that the planet is somehow superior to us, but that if we continue to follow our nests, we're not going to be here anymore.
No. Well, okay, the second thing is an economic falsehood. I think the real question here, the underlying sort of macro question, is whether human beings are net creators of wealth or net consumers of wealth. And I think if you look at the history of the human species, there isn't doubt that over time, man has made the earth a better place and has created wealth and has made it a more comfortable and a better place for the human species to live and to thrive.
That's, how do you know?
Excuse me?
How do you know?
Well, just look around you. Your life is better than someone's 20,000 years ago.
How do you know?
You're probably sitting in an air-conditioned room right now. You have food that you probably eat food that someone grew or produced halfway around the world.
You know, the Shoshone, for example, worked an average of 2 hours a day.
Who did?
The Shoshone, the tribe in what is now Nevada.
And they produced nothing.
That's right. They produced happiness.
Well, I think we produce happiness.
No, we produce stuff,
and we
try to get happiness from stuff.
I think people who are unhappy actually are people who mistake the first word.
I think working 2 hours a day is kind of a cool thing, you know, and hanging out with your kids and having family and having community. I mean, you look at most Aboriginal people, life isn't all that bad. But you know, rather than debating whether we want to go back to living, you know, in the Stone Age or whether the technological society is a wonderful thing, because I could debate either side of that argument, and it's really kind of moot. Let's get to the issue of... If you want to finish that point, go for it.
Well, do you think that man should stop inventing and creating things now? Do you think we'd have a better world tomorrow if everybody said, all right, we're not going to invent anything new, we're not going to create anything new,
I'm not suggesting that. And let's get on to the issue of population, which is where you started with that.
You agree with me on the economic point. You agree with me that man is a net creator of wealth and good things.
No.
So you say man is a net destroyer of wealth.
No. I'm saying it's not an either or question.
You won't admit
you,
it.
No.
You agree?
Give me a second. I'll explain what I'm thinking. You're saying in the most macro sense that over time what we call civilization has produced more and more benefits to humanity. I'm not going to argue that.
All right.
What I would submit to you, however, is that some of humanity has enjoyed most of the benefit of that. Right now there are 6 billion people on this planet. More than half of them are living on less than $5 a day. 2 billion of them are living on less than $2 a day. 1 billion of them currently are infected with malaria. You have, or with tuberculosis rather. 750 million of them are infected with malaria. You've got more human suffering on this planet than there were humans just 200 years ago.
That's a good point. You say some are enjoying more of the benefits of the creative imagination.
Let me make my point here, Terrence.
Let me make a point here, because I think you made a good point. And I'm going to add something to your point that maybe you'll agree with. Where is it that man is most likely to enjoy the creative, wealth-producing part of his nature? Where he is free. If you look where there is disease and poverty is where government interferes with man's God-given right to be free.
You mean like in Sweden?
Yeah. Exactly.
That's where the real poverty and misery is, in Sweden, where everybody has health care, everybody has old age pensions, they have state-run old age facilities.
And the government can euthanize
The Swedish people are just living a horrible life.
And Sweden's going bad.
Well, why is it that when the UN surveyed nations all over the world, they found that the Swedish people had the highest happiness index of anybody in the world?
If you honestly believe...
Why do they have a much longer lifespan than we do?
Excuse me. If you honestly believe that on net, the human species is better off where they lack freedom rather than where they have it, I just think you're defying, in fact, the obvious demographic.
You're defining freedom as the freedom to be economically dominated by large corporations. I'm defining freedom as the freedom to know that your basic needs are met. That's the historic, which takes us back to tribal times. That's the historic freedom. But let me make the point that I've been trying to make here for 6 minutes, Terrence. You said is population a good thing? Is the growth of population a good thing? I would submit to you that people have a good life. I'll agree with you when they're free, although we define it differently, but that freedom comes about as a consequence of the price of labor being high enough that the average worker can actually support a family. And that's a function of the supply of labor versus the demand for labor. And you guys are out there saying we need to have more and more people. Oh, my God, look at this. The populations are declining. If you look at what has happened after historic population declines, look at what happened after the Black Death. Look at what happened after the flu epidemic of the 1920s. What happened after those periods of time when large chunks of the population were destroyed is that the price of labor went up and a middle class emerged and life got better. Now, I'm not suggesting that we should euthanize people or that we should have, you know, God forbid, another epidemic. But I am suggesting that you guys are absolutely wrong when you say that negative population growth or zero population growth is going to be a disaster. It's going to be the best thing that could happen because it's going to increase the price of labor and it's going to lead to a strong and vibrant middle class, as it always has.
No, because each and every human being adds to us as a people. And each and every human being has the capacity to create more jobs and more wealth than he can consume for himself.
No. Well, that's the argument that if you had more people, you're going to have more Einsteins. And I'm telling you, if Einstein had been born in the slums of Bombay, he wouldn't have been Einstein.
Wait a minute. Any person listening to this show has to do is look around their own town and community. Not every single person in their town and community creates a business and creates jobs. But maybe one in ten persons goes out, creates a business, has an idea, creates wealth, he employs other people. He makes
it's not a numbers game. It's the consequence of being in a society where you've got an infrastructure that supports the ability to do that. And in those countries that are burdened by massive overpopulation, they can't do that. They've got people who are starving.
There is no country that is burdened by massive overpopulation. There are countries like, say, China.
You went around in the 60s when China had lost 30 million people to famine?
That get in the way of their people from creating wealth. And by the way, I completely reject the idea that relative human happiness is determined by relative human wealth. By the way, we're about to celebrate Christmas all around the world, which commemorates the birth of a boy to two poor people in a tavern in Bethlehem. Yeah, that was a happy family, right? They didn't need money to be happy, did they?
I think we've wandered a bit of field, Terrence.
But I reject the idea that human happiness is determined by relative wealth.
All right, so you think we need more people.
Relative wealth is determined by
population. In other words, we need more people.
Yeah, that's
okay.
More
Terrence,
more people.
Terrence Jeffrey, CNSnews.com. You can read all about it there. Thanks, Terrence. Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour. Let's just review those numbers one more time. All of human history to produce the first 1 billion people in the year 1800. At the time Jesus was walking around, Lewis, there were only 250 million people in the world, a quarter of a billion. By the year 1000, as the Crusades were beginning, there were only a half a billion people in the world. Would you say that the world was lightly populated? Actually, humans were occupying just about every nook and cranny on the entire planet. In 1800, when we hit 1 billion, indigenous and aboriginal people were still well over half the world's population. Their populations have been relatively stable for the last 100,000 years. It's the population of one culture that has exploded. One culture. It takes many different forms, it speaks many different languages, it uses different kinds of technologies, but it's essentially one culture. And there's one aspect of that culture that is driving this explosion in population. And it never gets discussed because it comes into collision, frankly, with most of the world's great religions. Not all of them, but, well, arguably all of them. I was just thinking, the week I spent with the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala, there were all these male priests and male monks, in Buddhism, in Hinduism, in Islam, in Judaism, in Christianity, right across the board. The first 1 billion people, 1800. The second 1 billion people, 130 years later, 1930. When the Great Depression started, there were only 2 billion people on Earth. Was it overpopulated, underpopulated? You know, if two-thirds of all the people on the planet were to vanish tomorrow, including two-thirds of all the people in the United States, would you say, oh, my Lord, there's not enough people? That was the population when the Great Depression started. The third billion people only took 30 years. It happened the year that John Kennedy was inaugurated. The population of the world was less than half of what it is today. The year Jack Kennedy was inaugurated, 1960. The fourth billion, only 14 years, 1974. The fifth billion, only 13 years, 1987. The sixth billion, only 11 years, 1999. What is driving this? There are two schools of thought out there that are widely accepted. They're both wrong. One school of thought suggests it's a problem of technology. We just need more birth control pills. Now, there is a problem. There is a very real problem with lack of contraception to people who want it. Planned Parenthood estimates several hundred million, 700 million, perhaps as many as a billion people around the world want access to contraception and can't get it, either because of legal problems or poverty or whatever. And to some extent, that's driving the growth of population. But that's not adding a billion people to the planet every 11 years. It's a problem. It's not the problem. Then there are those like the World Bank folks and the Republican Party who say, and the big transnational corporations and the think tanks associated with them who say, oh, well, the problem is that you don't have a big enough middle class. That when countries hit a middle class lifestyle, that all of a sudden you go to zero population growth or even negative population growth. And it kind of seems that way. It happened in Japan. It happened in the United States. It happened in Western Europe. Happened in the Scandinavian countries. That if you take out things like immigration, that by and large you have negative population growth. So it seems that way, but the fact of the matter is that there are countries that are very wealthy. You have countries in the Middle East where, you know, the average income is $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, even if you don't work, just as a share of the oil revenues. And they still have 10, 12 children. Populations are exploding among very wealthy people in various parts of the world. Why? Not only that, if it was just economics, you've got a big problem. Because if we raised the standard of living of everybody in the world, the half of the world's population is living on less than somewhere between $3 and $5 a day, depending on your numbers. If we raised their standard of living to that of an Appalachian family of four living at the poverty level, at $14,400 a year, it would require four planet Earths just to provide the natural resources. So it's not even a practical solution to try and raise the whole rest of the world to our level of consumption. I mean, it would be destructive of the planet. But it's also not solving the problem. The real problem, when you really look at these societies, what you discover is that in those societies where women have relatively equal power with men, population stabilizes in a single generation. And in those societies where women are treated like breeding machines, like cattle, where they are the property of men, populations explode. It's that simple. It's one of the reasons why indigenous and aboriginal populations, by and large, have never exploded in population. And our civilization started 7,000 years ago in various places all around the world, patriarchal, hierarchical, male-dominated, and women as the property of men's societies have exploded in population. So you want to fix the population problem? And it is feeding the global warming problem. You want to fix the population problem? Work for the worldwide empowerment of women. That's the only thing that will do it. And frankly, it's the one thing that most of the world's major religions are fighting against. 27 minutes past the hour. Four minutes past the hour. Just a quick heads up here. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to participate in our blog or our message boards. Also, there's a blog over at airamerica.com. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mike in Connecticut. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're very distorted. But anyway, you know, your guest from the last hour or this past guest you had is pretty much indicative of what I think most Americans are. They're totally divorced and uninterested in the natural world. I basically have been a naturalist since I've been a small kid, and now I'm a major bird watcher. I even illustrate birds for a living. And it saddens me to see how uninterested most people are in the natural world. And I think because they are so uninterested, they are also totally ignorant of the ramifications of their everyday actions on the natural world. And I think this is basically the major problem with what's going on with global warming and everything else. It's basically that people are uninterested and they don't see how they affect, you know, the world we're living in. And I think if they did know a little bit more about it, they would be a little bit more careful with their actions and their choices.
Yeah, well said, Mike. I mean, this is why I pointed out to our guest in the last half hour, 15 minutes ago, that his assertion that all of the world is here for humans, was put here just for us, is part of the kind of thinking that's not just destroying the world, but it's ultimately going to destroy us. It's very dangerous thinking. Chris in San Rafael, California. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tom. Good morning. You actually wanted to parallel a couple of things that the last gentleman commented on as well. And you know, a couple of things that when you were talking a little bit earlier about you were frustrated about civics not being so much a part of education, and I truly hope that overpopulation and sociology and, you know, folks really understanding carbon footprint and everything that I heard about way back in the 70s that really got me on a whole different level of thinking. I really hope that educators and a lot of the folks that are fortunate enough to be able to talk in the media about global warming really, really bring this to the forefront, because I think without really understanding this in depth, and I thank you so much for a lot of your astute insights with this, that I just don't think we're going to really be able to move forward with a lot of things. And so, you know, in a perfect world, I just really hope that educators and folks can really start talking about this and not having it, like you said, kind of this hidden subject.
Yeah. Education is a very important thing. And education is another one of those areas where the split between the genders is being maintained in those countries and in those cultures that want to oppress women. And I mean, you've got nations where it is illegal for women to go to school. And that's just, I mean, that's not only a crime against humanity, a crime against a species, a crime against the planet, but it, you know, it's feeding the problem. It's all the problems. It's feeding all the problems. Is it Janice or Janice in Seattle?
Janine,
I'm sorry.
Hey,
no, Janine.
It's like Janice with a J.
Oh, got it. Okay. Janice.
Okay,
hey,
thank
Janice.
You. Good morning, Tom. I just wanted to tell you that I agree with you about the whole patriarchy issue affecting economy and environment 150%, because, you know, I was raised Mormon. I'm now kind of more Taoist than anything, but there are certain religions in the world that, you know, like you were just recently reemphasizing, is that, you know, they view it that the earth is ours to plunder. God will always provide, and, you know, it will always be there. There's always enough for everybody. But the thing is, I think that they ignore the fact that, you know, if you're going to go back to the biblical sense, that, you know, it was given to us. This garden was given to us, and we're supposed to tend it. We don't have stewards. We don't have dominionship. We need to practice stewardship over what we have been given, and we're not practicing that.
Yeah, and you could argue in a purely, now it's almost a sociopathic argument, but absent any morality, okay, this argument would have to be absent any morality, but you could argue that in a world where the tribe that had the most young men to be in an army to fight other tribes, that would be the tribe that ultimately would triumph and would survive, and therefore we're all the descendants of tribes like that. And that in a world with relatively unlimited resources, that patriarchy and hierarchy, which produces large populations, the oppression of women that produces large populations, might arguably be, from a purely sociological point of view, as I said, separate of morality, might be, you know, in some kind of Darwinian sense, a good thing. But
right. That
time, if you want to make that argument, that time passed, in my opinion, at least 1,000 years ago.
15,000 years ago.
Yeah, arguably. And it just doesn't fly anymore, and yet it is still the foundational notion of many of the world's religions and of much of conservative thinking, and it is destroying this planet. And it is immoral. So, Janice,
that kind of sociopathic behavior like you're mentioning, I think that's an element in what's going on with some of the really bad sexual abuse and exploitation of women in Africa, in the, you know, genocide regions of Darfur.
In Darfur, yes, where they come in and they rape women simply to impregnate them with the Muslims impregnating darker African women so that they'll have children that look different from them as a way of breaking up their culture. That's not something new, by the way. That's something that's been going on for 7,000 years all over the world, and thus all the more the horror of it. Janice, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it.
Your
comments are well said and well met. Ryan in Tennessee. Hey, Ryan.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I was going to say that. All right. I just want to say you're great. You're a great thinking man, and there's not a lot of people who think on the radio, and just thank you for doing what you do. I just wanted to say it seems like with the population control on that topic, mm-hmm. it seems like, you know, Hitler and all those, you know, Mao and all these guys, it seems like they might have been attempting this either consciously or subconsciously or whatever. You know, it seems like they had this kind of fear of population taking over everything.
Well, Hitler actually had a program where they identified young women who were blonde and blue-eyed, and the SS impregnated them. And they produced the hundreds of thousands of children. They were referred to as the Sonnenkinder, the children of the sun. And they were going to be the master race. In fact, Robert Ludlum wrote a great novel just based on that as a MacGuffin. There's probably been 50 or 60 novels written about it. It's one of the things that a lot of people, it's well documented in William Shearer's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. A lot of people are unaware of it. But you're right.
It seems like what these neocons are doing, you know, like the whole connection between the Nazi family and Poppy Bush and all that, it seems like they're just following in the same steps. Like we kind of write off like what they're doing is just greedy. Like, oh, they're going to war and they're setting up all these camps just because of greed. And I'm thinking it's like more of a two-prong approach. They're greedy, but they also like kind of want to be like the managers of the human race, you know?
Yes, and I would
say we're gonna feed everyone this. We're gonna teach everyone this. We're gonna make everyone believe in this.
Keep in mind Adolf Hitler's program, and again, not to draw parallels to anybody in particular, but again, Americans forget this at their own peril. Adolf Hitler's program, and the German people believed in this right up until the early 40s, was 1,000 years of peace. He was going to bring peace to the world. The Third Reich was going to bring peace to the world, and it was going to do it with Christianity, and it was going to do it with eugenics, and it was going to do it with you know, the iron fist of state and church. And anyhow, enough of that rant. Maxine in Louisville, Colorado. Hey, Maxine.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to make a comment on the point you made earlier about in cultures where women are treated with equality, that the birth rates are lower. The fact of the matter is, from all the research that I've been able to find, in any country where you want to reduce poverty, the way you reduce poverty is by educating women and providing with birth control.
Absolutely.
Which
empowers them. And that gets back to I think the core thing is not whether they're smart or not or whether they have access to birth control. It's whether they have the power to say to men, no.
But those two things really are linked, because as a woman, if you can't control your ability to reproduce, then you can't control your life.
I agree.
So, you know, all the programs and all the money we spent, I was traveling in Africa, and you talk to all these people and the millions and millions and millions of aid dollars that are spent, and the only thing that seemed to work was when you gave women, like, control over wells, or you gave them birth control, you educated them, and it had long-term repercussions for them, for their children, their grandchildren, et cetera. So.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Maxine. And, in fact, among the Iroquois Confederacy here, you had five nations. In four of them, only the women could vote. Scott in Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Scott, just a half a minute here before we got to take a break. A quick one?
Yeah, a real quick one. I was just going to comment on the fact I'm a stay-at-home father.
Mm-hmm.
And
good on you.
I take care of two little boys, and I think you talk about the empowerment of women. My wife is a school teacher,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I've made sacrifices and whatnot to take care of my kids, but taking care of my boys and letting my wife kind of take over the financial prowess of our family and giving up that power has actually empowered me and made me closer to my children. And I think if a lot more men were closer to their children, the whole nation and the whole world might be empowered as well.
Well said, Scott. Thank you very much. Nice sentiment to end the segment on. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our number 866-303-2270. Our website, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And also there's a blog over at airamerica.com as well.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Before the hour, Alan Rander with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com on the line with us. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much. As you know, we cover both the United Nations and Washington. It's fascinating that this morning the United Nations, in two separate briefings, would not say that the bombing in Algiers was the result of Al-Qaeda. However,
Wait a second. I have apparently missed a news story. What's the bombing in Algiers?
Essentially, there was the United Nations headquarters in Algeria was bombed.
This morning?
Yes, at about 4:30 a.m. Eastern, 10:30 Algiers time. It looks like many people were killed. The United Nations headquarters there was several stories, and it came, it just was bombed. And there were several people that died there. Again, we don't have a final count.
Oh, this is terrible. I'm loading the New York Times homepage right now. I don't know how I missed this. I'm sorry.
Well, it's interesting because the White House is saying that this looks like it has the hallmarks of Al-Qaeda.
Well, the White House says that about, you know, litter at the Mall of America. I mean, you know, they say that about the Democratic Party.
Right. And, of course, the United Nations would not even go there on two separate briefings this morning
right.
at the United Nations. They would say they had no idea. This is just an investigation. At this point, they're just trying to get the people out and figure out who they have and who's alive and who's dead.
The organized group that is most aggressive in speaking out against the United Nations around the world is the Republican Party.
Well, of course, because the black helicopter crowd.
I'm not suggesting that the Republican Party or the hard right in the United States is responsible for this bombing, but I mean, if you want to say, oh, you know, who hates the UN? You can start there if you want your list. Anyway.
Exactly. Well, so the White House is going with Al Qaeda. The United Nations, whose building was bombed and who was missing people, will not say anything. On a few other issues, the budget. The Republicans had a briefing this morning in Washington. They said that this is the way Congress operates, that they're trying to pass this budget on the backs of veterans and troops. Excuse me, it was the Democrats that put in 0.5% more for troop salaries than the Bush budget had. And Obie is now saying, from the House, he said, okay, I'm going to meet the goal. If they say there's too much pork in this budget, and we're trying to add $22 billion to meet our priorities, I'm going to try and meet those goals, and I'm going to strip out all those earmarks, particularly the Republican earmarks.
Oh, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. All of a sudden, do you think that the White House will go silent on this, or are they going to continue to politically grandstand?
I have no idea. Obviously, the RNC and the Republicans are trying to grandstand on this issue, saying the Democrats are being irresponsible. Well, they'll be the time. We won't be irresponsible. We'll just take out all the...
Yeah, interesting.
And then what happens? That's going to be the game that they're playing. They also took out any idea of the Afghan money that they were adding in, and of course the Iraq money that they were adding in. So the Democrats then decided to play hardball and take that out as well.
Yeah, Ellen, I'm curious if there's any coverage being given at all to this latest CNN political poll. It just showed up this morning over on the CNN website, where they took Mike Huckabee and ran him up against Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John Edwards. Hillary Clinton beat him by 10 points. Barack Obama beat him by 15 points. John Edwards beats him by 25 points. I'm guessing that the corporate media that is afraid of John Edwards is not going to be reporting this. I've not seen it anywhere.
Well, no. And, you know, speaking of not reporting, there was that story yesterday about Kellogg Brown and Root and a woman who was raped and put in essentially a can and not
a shipping container,
water.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was not she was employee of Kellogg Brown and Root. Do you know that I looked this morning at all the mainstream newspapers? Now, I didn't look at the L.A. Times, but I was told by one of my hosts that it didn't make it in the L.A. Times. It made it in no mainstream newspapers, despite the fact that talk radio was all over it like a wet blanket.
Yeah, yeah.
So here you have it.
And it's all over the blogosphere, by the way. It's all over the Internet. Even Drudge is pointing to it, which is rare because it's, you know.
Right. Yeah, because Drudge didn't have it last night. But this morning, none of the local newspapers, New York Times didn't cover it, Washington Times didn't cover it, the Wall Street Journal didn't cover it. I mean, Washington Post didn't cover it. You wonder.
Do you think, isn't ABC doing a 2020 on this?
Yes, ABC, and actually ABC broke the story. But then if you looked at ABC's, now maybe it's moved to front page now, but if you looked at ABC's homepage, it wasn't on there. You had to go into investigative reporting, and then you had to sort of watch the various news stories as they filtered through. It wasn't even one of the written news stories. It was sort of on their moving written stories that they had. So it wasn't even top of their page, and they broke the story.
Yeah, you know, the most bizarre part of this story is something that I saw in the ABC story, which is that the odds are these guys will never be prosecuted, and they won't be prosecuted because George Bush's old roommate in Andover, L. Paul Bremer, passed a law in Iraq that said that Blackwater is not under U.S. law and doesn't operate under Iraqi law. They're completely in a lawless, and it's not just Blackwater; it's all of the private contractors there that they're not answerable to the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Which is exactly why when I was last in Iraq, a woman came up to me, and her son had worked for one of the contractors. As the translator was killed, she got nothing.
Nothing. Wow.
Nothing.
That's a tragedy. Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks for the update, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, we'll continue our conversation about population and food and the world, and then we're going to get to Anthony Romero at the ACLU.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the third hour of our program, live noon to 3 Eastern Time, 9 to noon Pacific Time, 5 days a week. 52 weeks a year. It'll be our sixth year in March. Holy cow, we've been doing this for a while. Yesterday, as the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, noted, Air Force Colonel Davis Morris resigned his position as the chief prosecutor for the military commissions at Guantanamo Bay after he was placed under the command of torture advocate William Haynes during a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing this morning. Senator Dianne Feinstein revealed that the Pentagon has blocked Davis from testifying before the committee. She says the Defense Department has ordered him not to appear. I mean, this is starting. We're starting to get into Alice in Wonderland world here.
I invited Colonel Davis to testify at this hearing. However, the Defense Department has ordered him not to appear. That, indeed, is very disappointing. We assured the administration that Colonel Davis would not be asked about pending and open cases, but we were told simply that Colonel Davis was active duty military, and because he was active duty military, they could issue an order that he had to follow. I think this is a real shame that we will not have Colonel Davis as a witness today. I think he has an important perspective. I wish the administration would allow him to appear. Unfortunately, I have to conclude that by prohibiting Colonel Davis from testifying, the administration is trying to stop a fair and open discussion about the legal rights of detainees at Guantanamo.
That's absolutely right. I mean, that's absolutely what's going on. Clive Smith's book, 8 O'Clock to the Windward Side, is, if it's not already up, it's going to be my Buzz Flash book of the month this month. And we interviewed Clive Smith last week, and describing the conditions of what's going on at Guantanamo. And not just Guantanamo. Do you realize that we are operating secret concentration camps all over the world? We have them in Iraq and Afghanistan, the obvious places. We have them in other, quote, undisclosed locations. The United States of America, your country and mine, running concentration camps where people are imprisoned without any rights whatsoever, without the ability to challenge their detention, all over the world. And this is what we're holding up to the world to say, hey, be like us. And we wonder why people like Robert Mugabe say, well, I'm not doing anything different than the United States is doing. It is a tragedy. It is an absolute tragedy. Our number, 866-303-2270, your telephone number, Bernard in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Bernard, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Just tying up a few things from last hour. Our class had an assignment or therapy. We were asked to paint Mother. We were dealing with Jungian archetypes at the time.
Good.
And a lot of anger and issues emerged. There was a lot of blacks and whites and jagged lines. The one mother appeared to be wearing a mask with a human eye behind it. And to me, I mean, that sort of hinted at sort of the misogyny in the culture and, you know, elsewhere as well. And also this attack on nature. You know, sometimes refer to nature.
Mother nature.
Mother nature, exactly.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. And as I've said on this program many times, if even in the political arena, if we discount the ongoing and continuing power of misogyny, the hatred of women, sexism, the oppression of women, and racism, you know, just frank racism, you know, we do so at considerable peril to ourselves. I think that we need to bring these things out and speak of them honestly. Rick in Orangevale, California. Hey, Rick, welcome to the show.
Hello, Tom. On the population thing, you brought up Einstein. He at one time said, "Not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted."
There you go.
Also, I think the Democrats and progressives are getting in the way of George Bush making the planet more sustainable.
Sure.
If he's allowed to bomb Iran, we'll have some fallout from that. The Russians and the Chinese will rush to secure oil supplies. We'll have regional wars. We'll have famine, and we'll reduce the population of the planet from 6 billion plus down to about between 3 and 4 billion.
Yeah, I doubt it would reduce it that much, but it would reduce it and not in a way that is healthier that we want to go with. I mean, but your point is well taken. The irony of your point is not missed. Joy in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Joy.
Hi. Yeah, my dad just called me this morning about this prosecutor for Gitmo because he knows him. And my question is this, is how in the world can the Pentagon get away with saying that this person can't testify?
They are...
in front of the Senate.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I'm guessing that if Senator Feinstein actually issued a subpoena that he may be compelled to testify. Although the White House, I mean, the, you know, the military is under the executive branch. So ultimately this goes up to Bush and Cheney.
Okay.
And so, via the Defense Department, via Robert Gates. And so, you know, where that subpoena would stop and when it would be challenged and how long it would take to adjudicate the thing. And, you know, I'm sure that they'd drag it out forever. And is the Senate up for that kind of battle and all these kind of things? I don't know, but the bottom line is that the military is taking the position that they can prevent their employees, essentially, from testifying. And I would say, if I was Senator Feinstein, okay, if this man does not want to testify, then let's get his employer in here. Let's get Robert Gates on the stand.
It's not him that doesn't want to testify. He wants to.
No, I understand.
He's blocking him.
Right. If you're not going to allow him to testify, then let's get you on.
And he actually did an op-ed today in the L.A. Times.
Oh, really?
Yes, where he's basically saying what he would have said to the Senate if he was allowed to testify.
That's interesting. That's interesting.
So you might want to look that up. I think I will.
I will track that down during the next break. Joy, thank you very much for the heads up on that. Casey in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Casey.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Just fine. What's up?
I was calling. I apologize if you've already covered this. I haven't heard your whole program this morning, but about the disturbing news that Nancy Pelosi and other top Democrats may have known about the waterboarding and other torture techniques being used as early as 2002 without really objecting, and whether we can now trust the Democratic leadership to actually take an active role in holding the Bush administration accountable for their actions. And I'll take the comments off air. Thanks.
Sure, yeah. Thanks a lot, Casey, for the call. It's a tough one. It's a really tough one to consider, because if you think back to 3 months after 9/11, which was 2002, September, October, November, December, 4 months after 9/11, there was a lot of terror in the United States. There were a lot of very frightened people. And we don't know what kind of presentation was made to Nancy Pelosi and presumably Jane Harman and Jay Rockefeller. We don't know the details of that. And they can't talk about the details of that. So I'm not quite ready to indict them. I'm not at all ready to indict them for it. It does raise a question I would love to see answered. But I don't know. We'll have to wait and let time sort that out. I think that Democrats, liberals in general, are so quick to jump in the circular firing squad, and we need to stifle that tendency. Liz in Valley Glen, California. Hey, Liz.
Hi, Tom. Good morning. I have two points I want to make. The first is our dearly beloved president is allegedly a Christian, and I was brought up a Christian. I come from a social services background. I want to know why one child has to be institutionalized. Any of these Christians, people who like to be Christians and don't believe in abortion, and we should have all these children, or make women have these children, should take in a retarded child, a severely retarded child, a mentally ill child, an AIDS baby, a drug baby. Any child...
Well, truth be told, Liz, actually many of them do.
But I
now, obviously not all of them and not the majority of them, but there are some good people out there who are taking children in.
I'm not saying that there aren't, but I guess I've had friends who worked in the Department of Adoptions, and you'd see women who were in prison. The children were in a foster care placement. Mm-hmm. The foster care parents wanted to adopt the child. The mother says, "Oh no, I love my child." And she wouldn't relinquish the child for adoption, yet she'd go out and get pregnant because she had no more money to feed her drug habit because she came out and did drugs again. So I'm thinking maybe if you have one drug baby, you should be sterilized. We should allow anybody to come into this country and let them be, you know, if they agree to be sterilized.
Yeah, it's a tough one, Liz. I mean, you're treading into a territory. At what point does reproductive freedom become a privilege and not a right? And that's one where you're going to find very little agreement with the American people. Most people consider having a baby to be a right, not a privilege. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
I got a letter from old George W. It said, "Son, I hate to trouble you, but this war of mine is going bad. It's time for me to roll those dice. I know you've already been there twice, but I am sending you back to Baghdad. George W. told the nation, this is not an escalation, this is just a surge toward victory. Just to win my little war, I'm sending 20,000 more to help me save Iraq from Iraqis.
21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Anthony Romero on the line with us. I am a proud card-carrying member of the ACLU. I recommend that you become the same. ACLU.org, the website. Anthony Romero, the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union. Welcome, sir.
Thanks, Tom, and thanks for being a member. We need to get many more members to make sure we push back on the rollback on civil liberties.
I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. The ACLU urging senators to end spying without court supervision. This and also this immunity for the telco companies that that helped out the Bushies on this. Where are we at on this, and what's the ACLU doing?
Well, we're pushing hard at Congress because we really think that Congress needs to fix the mess it made when it passed the bill just a couple months ago that's due to sunset in February of next year. And basically, it's like you said, Tom, there are two basic principles at stake. And it goes back to fifth grade civics lessons, checks and balances. That if the government's going to intercept our foreign phone calls or foreign emails to American citizens, you want to make sure you keep a judge firmly in the saddle. Because we know when we give the government that unbridled power, how it leads to abuse of those powers. And then the second part is that piece around telecommunications immunity, which is truly breathtaking that this Congress, especially led by the Democrats, would be considering it. I mean, here you have the president with his hand caught in the cookie jar, with the New York Times releasing a story in December of 2005 that the president by himself, without Congress and without the courts, authorized spying on Americans through the National Security Agency. And then almost 50 lawsuits brought by millions of customers have been filed against the various telecommunications firms. And that Congress is considering now bouncing those Americans out of court is truly breathtaking.
John, Anthony, I'm curious if I may change.
As long as you don't call me John Ashcroft. For
yeah, there you go. I'm curious if I can change topics just for a second here. We can
sure.
Get back to this if you'd like. Jane Harman's House Resolution 1955, now Senate Bill 1959, has been a flamethrower on the blogs and in the calls into this program. I've seen on the ACLU website one of your attorneys saying that the ACLU has some concerns about this. Do you intend to take a position on this?
Oh, yes. We're very much against the bill. It's an awful bill. And with all due respect to Congresswoman Harman, who normally we can work with pretty closely, this one she's exactly wrong on this bill. We don't need further anti-terrorism laws. We have laws that can be implemented and enforced. And we worry about the way the language of the law, the way it's constructed, will punish people because of their beliefs.
Right.
And
this is a thought crimes bill, basically.
Because of their beliefs.
Yeah, this is a thought crimes bill, basically.
It's a thought crimes bill. Yeah. It's an Orwellian government thought police bill. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. And what else is on your agenda right now, Anthony Romero? We're talking with the executive director of the ACLU, ACLU.org. Get over there and join if you haven't already. What else are you guys working on right now that you'd like to let our listeners know about?
We've got to close Guantanamo. It's a prison camp of no legal recourse. The Supreme Court heard a case earlier this week. We've got to make sure that if they establish the right to habeas corpus, that Guantanamo is shut down.
Why should we not call Guantanamo a concentration camp?
Well, you know, I think concentration camp evokes images of Jews being put to the gas chambers.
Well, those were the death camps. There were I think 300 concentration camps around Germany that were not the death camps of that were outside
the
country.
Guantanamo is awful, but I don't know if it rises to that same level that we saw in World War II. It is a prison camp of no legal recourse. They created a rights-free zone in Guantanamo, in a place where they could hold people indefinitely without access to the courts, and that's just un-American.
Yeah.
And then we have to restore habeas corpus. I mean, who would ever have thought, Tom, that we'd be arguing about the restoration of habeas corpus in America? It's one of the fundamental rights of our democracy, going back to the Magna Carta. And that this Congress hasn't had the guts to put forward a piece of legislation that restores the great writ of habeas corpus, it truly speaks to the spinelessness of these Democrats and these members of Congress.
Well, what's even more mind-boggling is that the Constitution explicitly says that habeas corpus can only be suspended during times of insurrection or invasion, and we've had neither. So how can Congress, I mean, why would Congress have to put it back? How could it, I don't get how it got taken away in the first place.
I agree with you, and that's exactly the questions that the Supreme Court justices were asking earlier this week when they heard that case on behalf of Guantanamo detainees. And habeas corpus is so basic. You're not letting the guys out if you grant them habeas corpus. You're granting them a mechanism that they can contest their unlawful detention. And that's just so basic that it should be a no-brainer, like you say.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And the spine without, back to the original point here, spine without court supervision. Do you know to what extent the administration is still spying on Americans? And is it possible, I mean, the most Orwellian and paranoid fantasies, is it possible that some of the spying might have been on Democrats?
Yeah, it's not Orwellian. We don't know the full extent of it because the government, of course, hides it all behind a shroud of secrecy.
I mean, this is what Nixon
was
doing.
The full extent of it. But I give you one case of a young college student, Kurt Gordinsky, one of our clients, who was organizing a war protest at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and then he finds himself on the Department of Defense Talon database labeled a credible threat against the nation. Now, that's
Whoa.
Just stunning, that a young college student exercising his First Amendment rights, handing out flyers, holding up posters, would be entered into the Department of Defense database.
That's mind-boggling. That's McCarthyism all over again. The ACLU, our last defense against the... Well, I don't want to overstate it. Our last defenders of the First Amendment and other rights under the Constitution, ACLU.org. Anthony Romero, thank you so much for being with us, sir.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour, 7 o'clock Friday night of this week, December 14th, I'll be at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at Coffin Memorial Union. So drop by and say hi if you happen to be in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. During the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on the legal rights of Guantanamo Bay detainees this morning, Brigadier General Thomas W. Hartman, no relation, I promise, good grief. General Thomas Hartman. That's creepy. The legal advisor at Guantanamo Bay repeatedly refused to call the hypothetical waterboarding of an American pilot by the Iranian military torture. So he's saying that they can do it to our guys. This is raising bizarre to a whole new level. I mean, that was the whole point. This is the point that John McCain kept making, was that he had been tortured. He knew what torture was, and torture is not what Americans do. And one of the reasons that torture is not what Americans do is that if we torture, then we set it up for our own people to be tortured. And do we want? And you know, that's not something that we want. Not only all the other issues of holding the moral high ground around the world and setting an example for other countries, but you also put your own soldiers at risk. Here's Brigadier General Thomas Hartman. It's with two N's too. Brigadier General Thomas Hartman.
Now, one of the issues.
And this is Lindsey Graham asking him.
In this guy,
Lindsey Graham, by the way, the Republican, who's also a JAG officer. He's also a judge advocate general or whatever they're called. He's a military lawyer.
Is waterboarding. General Hartman, do you believe waterboarding violates the Geneva Convention?
I was asked that earlier, Senator, and with regard to this entire issue, we start with the following premise. Torture is illegal in the United States.
We have a downed airman in Iran. We get a report that the Iranian government is involved in the exercise of waterboarding that downed airman on the theory they want to know when the next military operation may occur. What would be the response of, what should be the response of uniformed legal community regarding the activity of the Iranian government?
I'm not equipped to answer that question, Senator.
You are.
I will tell you the answer to the question that you asked in the beginning, Senator. And that
you mean you're not equipped to give a legal opinion as to whether or not Iranian military waterboarding, secret security agents waterboarding down airmen is a violation of the Geneva Convention?
I am not prepared to answer that question, Senator.
Thank you. I have no further question.
Lindsey Graham, the Republican, totally disgusted by the legal advisor at Guantanamo Bay, Brigadier General Thomas Hartman. Oh, man. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Tata in Michigan. Is it Tata or Tata?
It's Tata.
Hey, Tata. Welcome to the program. What's up?
Well, I think that I've heard, from what I've heard, you're kind of going, talking as though our government represents the people rather than corporations. And I think that if a person, you know, understands things like David Corton's book, When Corporations Rule the World, and then reads Naomi Klein's book, which I'm reading right now, I'm almost finished, on the Shock Doctrine, we can see that this was inevitable, that our government would represent the multinational corporations rather than the people. And last night I found out why it's gotten so much worse so quickly. And this is towards the end of her book, where she explains that during the Cold War, capitalism had an enemy, which was the socialists and the communists. And after the Cold War, the enemy was gone. So that explains a lot.
How so?
Well, if there's no enemy anymore, then they don't have to make it look as though capitalism has positive results for the middle class.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Because
they were
motivated before, but now they have no more motivation because they're unopposed.
Yeah, there's an upside to that from their point of view. There's also a downside, and that is that they don't have the terrified, cowed populace to say, oh, yeah, go, go, go. And that's where disaster capitalism, this is the point that Naomi Klein makes, and Tata, thanks for the call. This is the point she makes in a book, and that's where disaster capitalism is so much, it's a capitalism on steroids. It's the cancer stage of capitalism. Because now, hey, instead of fighting the Soviets with capitalism, we're fighting the entire world. We're fighting the war on terror. I mean, this is, you know. Wolf in Austin, Texas. Hey, Wolf, welcome to the program.
Hi, listen, I appreciate everything you're doing on the air, and I'm going to ask you a quick hypothetical, and this would have been a good one for the ACLU, too. Given the history of this administration for its penchant for recess appointments of loyal Bushies, and given the fact that the Senate was gaveled into session over the recent Thanksgiving recess, what do you think the constitutional implications would be if a president who has already bending the rules to his favor, decided to, when his vice president steps down due to health reasons, appoints his brother as unifying Republican force as an incumbent vice president?
You know, this is the question the Republicans were asking during the Kennedy administration when Jack made his brother Bobby the attorney general.
That's exactly right.
You know, they were all upset. I mean, they were hysterical. I frankly don't think that there's any chance. And the Constitution's pretty clear about the secession of the vice president, so I don't think that he would be able to get away with recess appointing anybody to replace Cheney. I am surprised, frankly, that Cheney has not yet stepped down. I've been predicting for 4 years on this program, or 3 years on this program, since the re-election, or since the apparent re-election of Bush and Cheney, that Cheney would step down before the term was out so that they could, you know, get a good Republican in there.
Have a new heir apparent, yes.
Yeah, a new heir apparent. But now I think that that's probably not going to happen because Bush has so badly tarnished the Republican Party that the Republican Party doesn't want to be associated with him. So if they want Giuliani or if they want Huckabee or whatever to be the next president, the last thing they want to do is make him vice president under Bush and use that bully pulpit because it's going to create a strong association with Bush. So I just, you know, it's an interesting point, but I don't think it's going to happen. Len in New York City. Hey, Len, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. You know, I was calling before that guy from the ACLU got on that, you know, after hearing you talk about, you know, the circular firing squad, you know, there's got to be some level of accountability that people can acknowledge when they're wrong. And I think that, you know, Nancy Pelosi should step down from her House of Representatives leadership over this torture, you know, visibility. I mean, just being
able. But
the
fact of the matter is, Len, that neither you nor I know what she saw or heard.
But
and she could go to jail if she told us.
Right, but we do know that
we know that the administration says that they told her something about what they were doing. We don't know what it was.
Well, they wanted to know if it was good, if it was strong enough. That's what we heard.
Yeah, but we don't know what they showed her. We just don't know. I mean, I am all in favor of holding elected officials accountable. I am all in favor of condemning elected officials who condone things like torture and waterboarding. I'm right there with you. And certainly, you know, I can give you a list of things where I disagree with Nancy Pelosi, although there's a lot of things where I agree with her. But, you know, at the top of that list would be taking impeachment off the table. I think that was a horrible, god-awful, terrible, tragic mistake. But on this issue, I don't think that, frankly, you or I are qualified to know whether or not she should be, to what extent she should be held accountable for that.
Gotcha. And, let me just be one more voice to recommend to anybody who's listening to read that book, The Shock Doctrine. It's unbelievable.
Naomi Klein. Yeah, no, we did 45 minutes with her on this show because it's such a brilliant book. But Len, thank you very much for the call. I agree with you. On Naomi Klein's book. It's the book of the year. Her and Naomi Wolf, the two Naomi, Naomi Wolf, The End of America, those two books, if you read no other books this year, are right up at the top of the list. Jeremy in Huntington Beach, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? It's really hard to get through to you, unlike the conservative people. So much for the free market determining like that. Anyway, I just wanted to point out I see a rift happening between Christianity and liberals these days.
And I see a rift between people who call themselves Christians but are actually pursuing an authoritarian agenda under the guise of religion. But I don't see a rift between Christianity and the Democratic Party or liberals. There are a lot of liberals and Democrats who are Christians.
That's exactly it. I personally think the media has selected certain people like Pat Robertson and Jesse Helms to represent Christians because they're hostile towards true Christianity.
And they're asserting that they are the true Christians, and all the more the tragedy. I mean, you know, I interrupted you. So.
But I think Hitler, didn't he actually, he was actually pagan. His whole religion was pagan, and he sold his ideals to Christians. And, you know, and they'll use anything. Their real religion is the love of money, and they'll use absolutely any means, you know, to get it. And I think that actually earlier you were talking about how, you know, women being empowered actually controls population. To remind Christians, I think the Bible says women were taken from the side of man, not to be trampled on him as if taken from his foot, nor she wasn't taken from his crown to be rule, you know, to rule him either.
Yeah, although you'll find Jeremy in the Bible plenty of misogyny and sexism. I mean, there's no end of it. The fact of the matter is that we have to understand that the times are different now. And, you know, I mean, you'll find the condoning of slavery in the Bible. You'll find the condoning of genocide, frankly, in the Bible. And, you know, times are different now. It's, you know, we just have to acknowledge that and say, you know, we are moving forward. I don't know how else to say it beyond that. And to hold up, you know, Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, you know, Jerry, blow them all to hell in the name of the Lord, Falwell. I just don't get it.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Burning up the atmosphere and cutting down the trees. The billion-dollar bombing of a nation on his knees. Anyone not marching to their tune, they call it treason. Everyone says God is on his side. See the lightning, hear the cries of the wounded in a world in holy war. Mortal thunder from the skies, killing everything they say they're fighting for.
Welcome back, 9.5 minutes before the hour. The Tom Hartman Program, by the way, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. TomHartman.com for our live chat room and our blog, also over at AirAmerica.com, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Kirsten in Aberdeen, Washington. Hey, Kirsten, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Well, I'd like to postulate that there's a cosmology to all this patriarchy, and it involves the complete transiting of the Milky Way by our Earth and Sun. It takes approximately 28,000 years, and at the end of it, we go from yang energy, which is patriarchal, to yin energy, which is female.
Isn't this, I thought it was like 22,000 years, and that's the amount of time it took to, or no, 2,000 years, and that's the amount of time it took to move from one astrological sign to another, you know, and or are you talking about the entire 12 sign cycle?
But... Yes, the entire 12 signs.
I see.
And the Buddhists have always been aware of this.
No, the Mayans were very into this as well. And
yes.
A lot of ancient religions very into it. So you think that we're coming around toward the back end of that?
We definitely are. And one of the signals of that is the passing of Venus, visible to the eye between the Earth and the Sun. We had one in 2006, I believe in the month of June. We are due for a second passage, which will be photographed again. And I do still have that picture, by the way. I love it. It will happen in August. So take heart. It's time for Jubilee for everybody.
Okay, great. Kirsten, thank you very much. Encouraging words. Pam in Eureka, California. Hey, Pam, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening on KGOE.
So many issues. So little time.
It's been a busy day.
What I want to respond to first is motor mouthing guests. You had a few guests ago. He suggested two things that you were fortunate to have. One was air conditioning, and one was having food that traveled around the world. Well, I suggest this guy read a book about the economics of food, John Robbins' Diet for a New World.
Sure.
This started with Francis Moore LePay back with Diet,
yes, Diet for a Small Planet.
The pure food and the local food movement is a very hot topic, the economics of food. And all the petrochemicals used in massive agriculture, agribiz, and the traveling, all this trucking things, instead of using local, buying local, growing local. The Cubans, incidentally, because of all the sanctions, have this great organic gardening thing or farming going. All these, I saw a whole thing on it on Free Speech TV.
Yeah, it's not that dissimilar, actually, from the victory gardens we had in the United States during World War II.
It's very positive. The other thing, I can't help but respond to, I think any complaints about this administration, any hope that they're going to do anything differently, you know, like impeaching him, like making them, you know, answer to all these accusations, it's not going to happen. They have set in place all the judges they need. All the power has been grabbed. So any attempt, I mean, this peace process, this is too little too late. This administration had a golden opportunity after 9/11. That's when they should have gone and done the Mideast peace process.
Oh, absolutely. Pam, you're spot on right. Right after 9/11, the Bush administration had the world eating out of their hands. I mean, they had there been a statesman or a stateswoman in charge of this country at that time, rather than a terrified little man, We could have world peace as a consequence of this. Islam could have undergone a significant transformation and modernization and reformation, because a lot of the world of Islam in the days after 9/11 was very enthusiastic about rejecting bin Laden-style fundamentalism, much as much of Christianity did after the horrors of the Inquisition. The Crusades, the Inquisition, and then even in the 1600s in the United States and Europe, the burning of women as witches. I mean, at a certain point, people look at the horrors of their religion and say, enough already, we're going to change. Anyway, Eric in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Eric, welcome to the program.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Well, hello.
Hello, Eric.
Hello. How are you doing?
Just fine. What are you calling about?
I'm calling about the information that you gave out about the empowerment of women and the population control.
Right.
And I was wondering where you found that information.
There are a number of good studies. There's a fair amount of good science on this. I wrote an entire chapter about it in a book of mine titled The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and I would refer you to that. Rhianne Eisler's written about it at some length, The Chalice versus the Blade. Rhianne has written a whole bunch of just absolutely great books you should check out. There's no shortage of sociological information, of good, solid scientific information to back that up. And not to mention, hey, common sense. Coming up tomorrow, Sam Kasman and I are taking opposite sides on the question of whether or not schools should be allowed to sell junk food. In our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, former decorated cop Barry Cooper says marijuana should be legal. Plus, the best of the rest of the news right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for we the people. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.